Oh, of course, how stupid me.
Test, test, test. This is Dave Crippen, and of the archives of the Edison Institute, and with a recorded interview with a senior automotive designer, Mr. Irving Bud Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N. We are in on Lido Key near Sarasota, Florida, and this is February 6, 1985. We are asking Mr. Kaufman, or Bud, as he is known universally by his many colleagues and friends, to tell us his career story in automotive design in his own narrative.
Okay, Dave, this is pretty much the story of my life as a designer, best I can remember. I guess that I started designing when I was 12 years old. I can remember that period when I would go down to the convention hall down on Woodward Avenue to the auto shows in the fall. And I'd bring home all the brochures of all the cars. And I'd proceed to redesign all the cars that were, you know, the brochures that I had. And then I'd show them to my mother and dad and say, see, aren't these better than the stuff that's down there at Convention Hall? And of course they agreed with me. But I knew that I was going to be a car designer at that age. That probably is the key age. Of course I had been drawing. I can't remember when I didn't draw things. And then in along with that interest, that redesigning of all the cars from the catalogs and the brochures, while I was in junior high school, I can remember belonging to a boat club that we had. And one of the projects was to build a scale model of the Garwood, the old Garwood boat. And we had a $1 spring-wound motor that went in the boat, but I didn't use the Garwood design. I did my own design, you know, and at that tender age of what, maybe 13, I redesigned the Garwood boat to my own liking, and it of course won all the races, and I attributed that to my design. However, I think it was because I built my boat lighter than. Looking back in retrospect, I probably built the boat lighter than anybody else built theirs. And of course, going through the model airplane stage that a lot of kids went through, my biggest thrill was to get a kit or the plans to an airplane, build it, and then redesign the airplane, and then redevelop all the ribs and the bulkheads and the surface development. So I, at a very early age, I was teaching myself what is a very sophisticated discipline of surface development. Of course, I didn't realize it at the time, but in order to get the shapes that I wanted out of the airplanes or the boats, then I would have to develop those sections and so that I could build the model to my design. Well, junior high school age period was a very intense period of my life of drawing and designing things like boats and airplanes and cars from a standpoint of not knowing that there actually was such a thing, not being aware really that there was such a thing as automotive styling. And at that time, of course, it was in the Depression, and I learned of a school that I could go to and get paid for going to school. It was the Henry Ford Trade School. And at that time, most of the kids that got into that school were sons of people who worked at Ford that had either died or were injured, or. And they had an in to the school that other people didn't have. But I found out, in discussing it with the boys counselor at the junior high school that I went to, that the Detroit Board of Education took two people each year from the Detroit Board of Education and into the school. So I made an application. And for 1 year, every Saturday, I hitchhiked downtown to the president of the Board of Education and said, when do I get into the trade school? And the day after my 15th birthday, I started in the Henry Ford Trade School. Of course, that was the beginning of my career at the Ford Motor Company. And I went through the Ford Trade School.
Can you tell us a bit about the curriculum there, how it...
Well, the curriculum in the trade school was, of course, aimed at being a tool and die maker. That was the basic curriculum that most of us went through. It was, the school was on a three-week period, and two of those weeks we spent in the shop, and 1 week we spent in the classroom. And the classroom gave us the academics, mostly mechanics and mathematics and some chemistry and things that really could be directly applied to the trade, and of course a lot of mechanical drawing and things of that nature. And we were told as soon as we came into the school that if we wanted a high school diploma, we had to go to night school to get the rest of the academic requirements for a high school diploma if we wanted to go on to a college program. And I started night school. My 15th birthday was in August, and I started night school that fall. And I went to school every night in the week and all day Saturday for as long as I can remember, up until the time I went into the service. And then when I got out of the service, I started back at Wayne State and worked toward a degree in fine arts and specializing in industrial design.
Where was the trade school?
The trade school was in the B building at the Rouge plant.
In Dearborn.
The old B building was the building that they had built the U-boats or the Eagle boats. And that the third and fourth floors of that building were the trade school shops and classrooms.
Did you ever meet Frederick Searle?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, one of the first occasion that I had when I met him, it was because I had been caught drawing while my lathe was running. I was running some long stock, and I was sketching things around in the shop while I was waiting for the tool to come through. And my instructor sent me up to Searle. And Searle said, what were you doing? I said, I was drawing. He said, where are your drawings? And he sent me down to get them. And he instead of bawling me out for it, he said, well, you don't want to be drawing while you're working on that lathe. It can be dangerous. But he took an interest. He took an interest in guys that had a little different approach than just the regular tool and die program. And it did help me. Later on, it helped.
Gave you a good basic working knowledge of mechanics.
Well, the advantage that people like I had in the design field is that we had a working knowledge of the tools and how cars went together from the ground up. And when you start in at 15, at the age of 15 in the car business, we worked in the trade school. We had periods in all of the disciplines of the shop, and including foundry and metallurgy and wood pattern shop and metal pattern shop and all of the tool room machines, shapers, lathes, grinding machines, the whole gamut of a regular toolmaker's trade.
Mm-hmm. Training.
It was invaluable, and that, along with my interest in art and my first sort of formal introduction to art was a correspondence art course. And
what was that?
There were these little draw me things in the newspapers and magazines. And you draw that,
match
you copy
covers.
It.
Inside of match covers?
No, this was a little ad.
Okay.
And it was there was a correspondence art course.
Right.
But if you did the best drawing of all of those that were sent in. You got the course cheaper or free or something. Well, I sent that in, and of course the guy knocked on my door and sold me the course. Well, and I worked on that, you know, in my other free time. I was going to the Northwestern High School for night school and taking the other English and academics that I needed to get the high school accreditation. Then I discovered that there were art schools in Detroit. There was such a thing as an art school. And I started going to Meinzinger Art School and Society of Arts and Crafts, which is now the Center for Creative Studies.
Right. Where was Meinzinger?
Meinzinger was on Woodward, right off, not Watson, was downtown. That's where the Society of Arts and Crafts was. Right. Meinzinger was up closer to the Boulevard, just south of the of Wayne State on Woodward. And it was one of the leading art schools in the city, commercial art schools. And that's where we did a lot of life drawing and learned some of the commercial techniques and some airbrush, introduction to the airbrush work and stuff like that. I spent a lot of time on in the life drawing work because I felt that I had done so much mechanical drawing and artwork, mechanical kinds of artwork, that I felt that the life drawing would give me a little different perspective on my ability to draw. And it worked out real well, and I of course developed an interest in all kinds of art. The design aspect of my art was well established. I was going to be a designer, period, and somehow or other. And the things that I was doing without knowing it were leading up to that career. One of the critical things that occurred during my early years, I think, it was just before I started in the trade school. I was visiting an uncle who was the production superintendent for Cordon Auburn. This uncle, my uncle Frank, my mother's brother, had been a driver in World War I, and he was the private driver for General Pershing. And when he got out of the service, he had no education, but Pershing liked him, and he gave him an introduction to Augie Duesenberg. And he told Augie Duesenberg to hire Frank, and Frank rose through the ranks of Cordon Auburn. And anyway, he was the production supervisor for Cordon Auburn down in Connersville, Indiana. He had started in Kalamazoo with them, and then they moved down to Connersville. And I was down there visiting one day, and he knew that I was going into the trade school, so he took me in one Sunday and took me through the shop at the plant. Took me all through the place and showed me everything, and I was very interested in all that stuff. And we walked upstairs on a balcony, and the door was open to the design room. And I looked in there, and I stopped, shocked still. I looked in that room, and my mouth dropped open, and Frank said, "Are you interested in this stuff?" And I shook my head, and we went in, and we looked all around, and this is the first time I'd ever seen an automobile design studio. Now, that was in 1934. I was maybe 14 years old. And he picked up a bunch of drawings, and he said, "Here, take these home with you." And to this day, I still have a couple of those drawings. Now, that 14, and I'm 64 now, so that's, you know, that's what, 50 years ago?
Yeah.
50 years ago. And one of the drawings that I still have is one that was done by Alex Tremulous. He was in that group down there at that time. I still have that drawing. And there were drawings that were done by Italians that had sent designs over to the States for Duesenberg and so on. But so that career, that the interest in art and going to the art schools in Detroit and working in the trade school, being in the Ford Motor Company, being in love with cars and airplanes, especially airplanes.
Perfect environment.
It was, you know, it was a natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
And when I graduated from the trade school, I had taken some drawings over to the design center. Now, when I graduated, that was in 38 from the trade school. And things were really kind of strange because of the World War II activities that were going on with England, and the Ford Motor Company was in a little bit of a state of flux, and they didn't want to do anything in the styling area at that time, and I probably wasn't good enough to get in at the time anyway, and so I stayed in the drafting department at the trade school, and then I was hired, then I was moved over to the tire plant. And I designed the tread design. This is my first actual design job for something that was used. Mm-hmm. And it was the side tread design on the Ford tire that Ford manufactured. They subsequently sent that whole tire plant to Russia.
I'd like to hear the story when you get to it.
We were building tires,
right.
And things were generating and helping the war effort, and I don't know when, what the dates were that Russia became one of the enemies of Hitler, but at that time Henry decided to help out, and he sent the whole tire plant. He dismantled everything and sent it to Russia so that they could build tires. So I'm sure that my tire design was used on Russian vehicles. And then I was called back to what was called the Ford Apprentice School, mm-hmm. as an instructor. And the idea was...
It was part of the trade school complex, wasn't
it? Well, it was...
So the next step up.
It was the next step up, and it was controlled by the training and education department, but it was a separate entity.
Right, exactly.
And... I was brought back in as an instructor. Now, I was the youngest instructor that the trade school or the apprentice school ever had. And the idea was, this was an ambitious idea that Fred Jones, the head of the drafting department in the apprentice school had, was to set up a program similar to the General Motors, a styling school, in conjunction with their surface development program that they taught engineers. And they wanted to sort of combine some of the disciplines of the aesthetics and the mechanical parts of it. And the apprentice school was teaching a pretty strong program in surface development.
Really?
And the idea was that I would sort of generate some kind of a design school. Well, I was flattered, but I didn't know the first thing about how to set up a design program. I wasn't even a designer, really. And of course, at that time, things went to hell, and the war came along. I signed up for the cadet program and was accepted as an aviation cadet, and went through the training and was a pilot during
the Army.
Army, Air Army. Corps.
You were a pilot?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. How
well, you know, it's interesting with my love of cars, but airplanes especially. On Saturdays, I'd hitchhike out to Selfridge Field
uh-huh.
as a little kid.
Uh-huh.
And it was easy to hitchhike in those days, you know, it was relatively safe. And I'd go out there and stand by that cyclone fence out there and watch the old P-26s and P-12Es come in and land. And
mm-hmm. right.
So I always had that burning desire to be a pilot. Well, the war gave me that opportunity.
Uh-huh.
And
I
went through the Southeast Training Command through Georgia and Alabama and then I was an instructor, a single engine instructor in AT-6s in Moultrie, Georgia.
The old Texan.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Were you
I
pilot?
Was Navy, yeah.
Navy pilot? Yeah.
We flew SNVs.
Yeah.
SNJs.
J's,
yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, we had several Navy pilots in styling too.
Did you?
Jimmy Morrison was a Marine pilot.
That's right.
Frank Bianchi was a Navy pilot. Don Del Rosa was an Army pilot.
Yes, very much.
And we had Ken Nelson was an Army pilot. There were several pilots in that group. And then when the war was over, I had been thinking of what do I want to do with my career. I don't want to be a teacher. Now, I didn't know whether I wanted to be an illustrator, an automobile illustrator, or a designer from a standpoint of career. And, you know, I had always thought of myself as a designer, but illustrating was fascinating to me, too. So I went around and talked with different people in the business, illustrators, designers. I made the decision that I wanted to be a designer, that was it, that I could get as much satisfaction out of the illustration that I would do as a designer, although they're two separate disciplines. And the more design work you do, the less illustrating you do.
Yeah.
And that's the way the nature of the business is. And of course, the more successful you get in the business, the less you do of the illustrating and the less designing you do too. Mm-hmm. You've got people that are younger people doing it, and of course, I'm jumping ahead now, but that's of course what happened when we retired. I think they were happy to see some of us older guys go, and with the economic times and so on, and it was darn nice that we were able to get out at that age and be able to feed ourselves too.
Come up with a good retirement package.
Yeah. I think that those of us that were in the design business and the car business were really lucky in that respect. And well, now let's go back to getting out of the service. I went back to Ford.
Well, now, where were you discharged from?
In Detroit, at Romulus.
Romulus, okay.
That was my final discharge. I was actually, I'd come back from Europe. I was in Europe. As a troop carrier pilot.
Oh, yes.
Flying C-47s and C-46s.
What theater?
In ETO.
Uh-huh.
And the war ended over. I wasn't over there very long. I was an instructor for quite a while.
Yeah,
and then I went into B-26s, and then from there into the troop carrier area, and went overseas in the troop carrier as a troop carrier pilot.
I've often heard that the B-26 was rather an unstable aircraft.
Well, it was a hot airplane,
yeah,
and
yeah.
The early, I didn't fly any of the early 26s.
Okay.
The later 26s that I flew had 11 foot more wing spread.
Mm.
So I can imagine what the early ones were. You know, the 11 foot extensions that we had were bad enough. You know, you flew your traffic pattern at traffic pattern altitude, and you got lined up with the runway, and when you lost sight of the runway, you cut everything back, and when it looked like you were going to hit the ground, you pulled back, and you know, you landed. Everything was a crash landing, unless you dragged it in for a long way. But and then I went into C-47s, which was just the opposite. It was the easiest airplane in the world to fly. You could wait till the last minute and go around, and it was really an easy air. It was a great airplane. So I came back from Europe for rest and recuperation, and I was scheduled to go to the Pacific. And while I was home, the war ended in the Pacific. You know, the whole thing ended out there. And I went on out. I kept expecting a telegram to stay home, but never came. So I went on out. We were scheduled to go out to California and then go to the Pacific. And I got out to Merced Army Air Base. And was there for a couple of months waiting for things to happen, you know. And I wound up as a private pilot for the commanding officer out there, and so I got to see quite a bit of California.
Good.
then I got home. He tried to talk me into staying in the Air Corps. He said, "You got a real career, you know." And I said, "Well, I don't think that I want a career, a military career." The kind of flying that military flying wasn't the kind of flying that I had in mind. You know, I had in mind being a war ace, another Eddie Rickenbacker, I was going to fly P-51s and be a hero, and of course all that changes in the course of events. And anyway, I didn't want to be a commercial pilot, or I didn't want to fly military troop carrier or anything else.
Yeah.
So I opted out and went back to Ford, and I went back to the apprentice school and made it known to everybody that I, you know, that I was, that I would like to work in styling in the design department at least for a couple of years to find out what it was like before I tried to set up any kind of a program. Well,
was this the autumn of 45?
This was the winter of 40, the winter of 45,
46,
right, or 46.
Yeah.
And then in the spring, when they stopped their classes in the apprentice school,
yeah,
I was loaned to the design department, to styling.
Oh.
And I went over there on a loan basis, and I was immediately put with a fellow by the name of Ross Cousins. I don't know whether his name has come up in your...
Yes, Mr. Gregory spoke of
him. Well, Ross was a fantastic guy and an absolutely incredible illustrator. He didn't do a lot of design work because Gregory and Hibbard, Tom Hibbard, was there with Gregory at the time that I came over. But I was given to Ross to be his right-hand man, and I did all his dirty work. I did his tracings for him and a lot of the drawings, and then he would do the rendering.
Mm-hmm.
And Ross was, I really loved the guy. He liked me, and we had a lot of fun, and I was learning what car design was all about, you know, from the inside. Well, in the middle of the summer, Ross ups and quits, and he's in the middle of a project of illustrating a whole line of cars based on a design that Gregory and the guys had worked up, and Ross was illustrating the whole line of cars, station wagons, two doors, and with background figures and scenes and things.
Mm-hmm.
And he had let me do some wheels, and then he had let me do some chrome, and
mm-hmm,
and so I was developing my rendering techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Ross quit, and bought,
remember why?
Well, he wanted to get into the advertising business.
Ah, okay.
And he had an opportunity with a couple of other guys to buy out an advertising studio.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, and it was Laudrier Studios. He was hired by Laudrier at first, and then they had the chance to buy into the studio, and they were one of the big successful car illustrator studios in the city.
Do you remember how that was spelled?
Laudrier, capital L-A, capital D-R-I-E,
R-E,
something like that.
Yeah, Laudrier.
Yeah, Laudrier.
Mm-hmm. They were a prominent Detroit organization.
Detroit. Advertising studio, art studio, and the art that they did was mostly for the automobile business.
Mm-hmm.
And Ross went with them.
Uh-huh.
Well, Hibbard said, well, can you finish this project? And I said, sure I can. So I finished the series of illustrations using the same style that Ross started with, you know, his technique and his style of rendering. They were pastel renderings.
Yes.
And I finished them up, and by this time it was getting close to the end of summer, and summer of 46, and I told Tom, I said, Tom Hibbard, I said, you know, I'm scheduled to go back to the apprentice school. And he says, forget it. He said, you don't want to go back there, do you? I said, hell no. And he says, forget it, I'll take care of it. So.
Right.
So I never went back. I stayed there.
Uh-huh.
Now, naturally, when I got out of the service, I started back to work at the same pay that I was making when I went into the service, which wasn't bad, because I was, you know, I was an instructor in the apprentice school, and I was making pretty good money, but I wasn't making the kind of money that some of the guys were making like Najjar and Bill Schmidt and some of those fellows that had stayed there.
Yeah.
I don't know how they got raises during that period of time, but they were getting them.
Yeah.
And I started yelling about it. Well, Hibbert did everything he could. He gave me a couple of raises and he wanted me to be happy and several months after that, some of the guys started coming in from GM. At that time, that I was concerned about money, and I had a fast taste of the design studio world with Hibbert and Gregory and Ross and John Najjar was there, and Jim Huggins, Bill Schmidt, Ted Hobbs. Ted Hobbs was there when I came there. Now he came from GM, but he came earlier than this other group that started coming in. Like,
George. We've not heard much about Hobbs. Can you
well, Hobbs was sort of the interior. He was our interior man
mm-hmm.
when I came into the design, the styling area.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Ross were very good friends, and
Ross Cousins.
Ross Cousins. And Ted Hobbs was a very sophisticated designer, very competent. He was probably one of the best designers that they had in the design department. Bill Schmidt was a hot designer, young guy. Bill Wagner was there, and Bill was...
This is Willis P. Wagner.
Willis P. Wagner, Bill Wagner. And Bill took me under his wing, and I adopted Bill as a father because Bill and I talked a lot. And I remember one time I had a very young son that was born while I was in Europe. And when I came home, I was flabbergasted with this kid, you know. And one day I was asking Bill, I said, Bill, I have a lot of respect for you. You're an intelligent man, but you've never had any kids. But if you had any kids, how would you raise a son? And Bill says, well, Bud, he says, if you want him to be happy, love the hell out of him. If you want him to be successful, frustrate the hell out of him. So all my life I tried to play it both ways, you know, loving him and frustrating him.
Yeah.
I guess that was the result of that. But I had a lot of respect for Bill. Bill was a trained, educated architect and had a very fine design sense decided to be a car designer. I guess maybe he couldn't get a job as an architect during the Depression, and started in there. And he was a very competent designer. And at that time, as I was saying, I wanted more money. I had this young family, and Kaiser Fraser was there. They were looking for designers. And they were making offers that were pretty intriguing. And I started asking around about, you know, different places. And at that same time, Elwood Engel and Joe Orris were working in our area as consultants with George Walker. Now, George Walker was brought in by Ernie Breach. Ernie Breach was, and of course, now you get back into the period where young Henry has taken over the Ford Motor Company. While during that first few months that I was there, Henry, number one, died.
Yeah.
And right after Henry died, then things really generated. Action was really generated. And I think the story of the family, of Henry's mother, and the power of who's running the company and how the company should be run was being decided on, and
right.
At that time Ernie Breach was brought in by Henry or by Henry's mother or the family or somebody.
Ernie but was involved too.
Yeah, but evidently it was to give young Henry an education, and Henry came back to the Ford Motor Company. As a matter of fact, just before I left for the Air Corps, he was brought back out of the Navy. He was in the Navy at the time, and we had a huge naval training program going on. This was another of the things that was going on in the apprentice school. We were teaching the Navy, and we had a lot of the Navy personnel in our classes, in our math classes, and I remember that in one of my math classes that I was teaching along with some of the other things I was doing, Henry walked in my class one day.
Really?
And now I had met two of the Fords. I had met Henry's grandfather. The day we graduated, I was president of our graduating class, and I was giving a talk in the Rotunda Auditorium. That's where we had our graduation exercises.
Yes.
And Henry, number one, came walking down the middle aisle and walked up on the stage and shook my hand and made a few comments, and I was, really flabbergasted with that. But I had met those two Fords. And when young Henry walked in my class as a naval officer, just to sit in on the class to see what was going on, it was kind of an interesting experience. Well, now we go back to after the war and Ernie Breech taking over, running the company, and what the problems that he was running into. And I think that he obviously was very instrumental in getting the Snyder and Oswald. He was working to get Oswald over. Oswald was one of the big men at General Motors Styling.
What was his forte? What was his?
He was a designer.
He was
a designer.
Yeah.
And he sort of emulated Harley Earl.
He had worked
with Harley Earl closely. And he was a big Oswald was a big man. Like Harley Earl was, and he sort of emulated the style, I think that the reason why Snyder came before Oswald did was that Oswald knew he was coming, but the timing wasn't quite right for him, and he got Snyder over there ahead of him, and Snyder started setting things up.
Now, what was Snyder's background?
He was a designer from General Motors, and I don't know specifically the areas that he was responsible for, but he was a very well thought of designer at that time at General Motors, and then they started bringing in the people from General Motors, their team,
right.
Bordenay and De La Rosa. Now,
De La Rosa came over from GM.
Yeah.
Oh, I hadn't realized that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Gene Gordon.
Let's see. Let's see if I can. Snyder came, and I could see.
George Snyder.
Mm-hmm. And I could see, and there were a couple of modelers that came over early.
Who they were?
Bianchi or?
Beinecke.
Mm-hmm. Came over.
B-I-E-N-C-K-E.
I think that's it, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Short, husky guy, a terrific modeler.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of George's close friends over there, and he brought
George
him
Snyder,
over,
yeah.
George Snyder. He brought him over, and I had the feeling that these guys were going to take over styling, and I was going to be, sitting on the back deck someplace. So, and we had all kinds of opportunities to go other places, some of us did, and about that time, as I say, Elwood and Joe were there, and I'd been working pretty closely with Elwood Engel and Joe Orris,
mm-hmm.
On the 49 stuff that we were doing.
Ah, yes.
And the original Ford Styling Group had a car ready, and then Walker brought in another car, and that car was the car that was ultimately picked as the 49 Ford, and the car that we had worked on was a little smaller car, but it was then sort of diverted to be the French Ford, the post-war French Ford.
Now, this was under Gregory.
Under Gregory,
okay.
Right. Gregory was still there. Now, let me see if he was still there.
Well,
it was right about that time he left.
Right.
And Tom Hibbard was running styling.
Yeah. Did you feel that Gregory had a premonition that...
Well, Gregory was a strange man.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I don't think anybody that ever knew him ever felt any kind of affinity toward the guy. I don't think you could ever get close to Gregory. He was a strange person. I think he was talented. I don't think there was any question about that, but he was a very suspicious person. I think he had a lot of fears. Maybe he had the premonitions that he was on his way out. I never got close enough to him to mm-hmm. to know really how he thought.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, being a young designer and being as egotistical as I was, I always felt that I was the greatest designer there was around anyway. And I would argue with Gregory to a certain extent because I didn't know enough not to argue with him. Of course, I've argued with my bosses all my life. And
was this working on the immediate post-war facelifts
yeah,
that you were doing?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And...
The 46 and 47s, 48s.
Well, not the 46 and 47s. They were old cars.
Okay.
And we didn't do much with those things. They just put those things into production
yeah.
and started building cars.
Right, yeah.
And it was interesting. I didn't have a car when I got out of the service. I had a 41 Ford convertible when I went in, and I sold it before I went in, which was a pretty dumb thing to do. But I tried to get a car when I got out of the service, and my father found an old 36 Chevy for me that a friend of his had that he would sell me cheap, and I drove that for a few months, and it was the most horrible thing that I ever had. It finally froze up on me, and I called the used car lot, and I said, I got a 36 Chevy. You want to buy it? And the guy said, yeah. How much you want for it? I said, $300. He says, well, bring it down, and I'll take a look at it. I said, I can't bring it down. It won't run. He says, I'll be right out. Came out, bought the thing, and hauled it away. Anyway.
You sold it for about $600.
Yeah, I sold it for what I paid for it.
Yeah.
It was... But I kept bugging the Ford dealers about getting a car,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they wouldn't even take my order. And I was reading in the paper a little squib about Studebaker starting in production, and nobody in Detroit ever buys a Studebaker. I'll get on there. I'll get on the... So I went down, and I put my name on the list for a post-war Studebaker. And the dealer kept stalling me, you know, they were getting cars, and I'm sure they were selling them for money under the table, and I wasn't indicating that I was going to do anything like that. And then I waited and waited, and then I see the promotion on the new post-war design Studebaker, and I'm glad I didn't get that out, because this post-war Studebaker is really a hot-looking car, and I ultimately got one.
Did you?
A business coupe. I had told the dealer that I would take anything that he got in except a business coupe, a three-passenger business coupe. And I kept going down there and bugging him, and when am I getting my car? And one day the manager of his place said, Bud, we got a business coupe in here, and I know that you don't want it. He says, but if I were you, I'd take it. So I called the owner and I said, Nagel, have you got a car in there? He said, Buddy, he says, I got a business coupe here. He says, I know you don't want that, but that's all I got. I said, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I bought it and I brought it out to Ford. And I don't think that car was there 3 hours, and I got a call from Henry Ford's office.
HF2? And,
huh?
HF2?
Henry Ford II's office.
Uh-huh.
And the call was, Mr. Ford would like to drive your car.
Oh.
I said, fine. So they made arrangements to get the car, and they took it over, and he drove it. And then it came back. And
did you ever get any reaction from him on that?
No, but they wanted the car.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't give it to them. They wanted to give me a Mercury for this Studebaker. And I said, look, you guys have been... You wouldn't get me a car when I wanted one. I think this is a good-looking little car, and I like it.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting 42 miles to the gallon on it, you know, at that time, that was incredible, so I kept the car. Well, what I did, I took out the back package tray, and I built in a seat, a little jump seat in the back for the kid, for my son, and and I drove that car. Anyway, that influx, or that transition period with the GM designers coming in, just gave me a little more push to get out into the world and see what the rest of the design world was like. And about that time, Exner, Virge Exner from Studebaker contacted me.
This is Virgil Exner.
Yeah. And he had been Raymond Loewy's chief designer before the war and during the war. And they had developed this post-war Studebaker. And of course, I was fascinated and impressed with the car and had one, had that Studebaker coupe. And X came up because of some political maneuvering that had gone on at Studebaker, with Loewy firing Exner because of some design work that Exner had done in his basement, and denied it, said that the design was done by Bud Manufacturing. And I think that that part of that scenario is that the chief engineer at Studebaker didn't like Loewy personally.
Loewy was on a consultancy.
Loewy was a consultant. He had the contract to do the design work for Studebaker.
Right.
And Exner was his man. Exner had worked at General Motors styling. And Exner had gone with Loewy to run that job, that contract.
Before the war or after?
Before the war.
Yeah,
there were some other. Claire Hodgman was another General Motors designer, an older designer that was really of the Virge Exner era. Claire Hodgman.
How do you spell his name?
Claire Hodgman. C L A R E. Hodgman. H O D G M A N. And Claire and X were at Studebaker. Bob Burke, who was Bill Burke's brother.
B-O-U-R-K-E.
Right, Bill Burke ultimately came to Ford and was a vice president. It was interesting.
Right.
But Burke was there. Bob Cotto, who was very instrumental in doing the 49 Ford while he was working for Raymond Loewy in South Bend. And
K-O-T-O.
Yeah, Bob Holden.
Holden was the
Holden, friend. Bob Cotto.
Right. Mm-hmm.
K-O-T-O.
Mm-hmm. So you went down to take a look at the situation.
So when X came up and called me and said, I understand you're looking for a new job. I said, yeah, if I can make enough money. He says, can you come down to the hotel? He had come up and was in a hotel downtown, and I went down. And
now, forgive me, where had Exner heard of you?
Yeah, X had got word from Elwood Engel and Ted Hobbs that I was a good designer. And that I was would be interested in leaving for more money.
Engel was working then with the George Walker team.
Right.
Who we were consulting it for.
Right.
Right.
And so X called me. I went down and talked with him, and he said, when can you start? And I said, well, 2 weeks. I said, don't you want to see my portfolio? He said, no, you come on highly recommended. And
right.
So I went. I went to South Bend to work directly for the Studebaker Corporation under Virge Exner. And we did.
Exner was director of styling for Studebaker?
For Studebaker. It was a small group, not as big as the Loewy group. And X came up and got me and a fellow by the name of Randy Farreau from General Motors Styling.
How do you spell that?
F-A-R-O-U-T, Farreau, Randy Farreau. And Randy and I went down to Studebaker, and we were the design department. Randy and I and Exner and one other fellow that was an artist, not really a designer, but Ed Herman was down there, and he was hired as a designer, but he was more an artist than he was a designer.
Now that was the Exner group.
That was the Exner group.
Working directly for Studebaker.
Right. And we had an office out in at the Studebaker Proving Ground.
In South Bend.
And the Raymond Loewy Group had an office. Their office was in the Studebaker Truck Plant, which was a new building south of town, where they had built trucks during the war, and it was a very modern facility. Our environment was a lot more laid back. It was out in the country, and we'd go out and play with the ducks during our lunch hour. It was a very informal little group, and we did a car. We were preparing for the new facelift for that 47 Studebaker, mm-hmm. and it would be the 50, the 1950 Studebaker.
Where was the plant located?
In South Bend.
But I mean, you said you're sort of out.
The design and this design group that Exner had, and a little body engineering group of guys were out there, and we were working on this project in competition with Loewy.
Yeah, okay, good.
And we...
forgive me, who was heading up Studebaker at this time, the corporation? Do you remember?
Churchill was not yet. Churchill was not quite yet the president. Let me see who... I can't remember.
Churchill was executive vice president at the time?
Yeah.
What was his first name?
Harold. Harold Churchill.
So he was the coming...
He was power. Ultimately the... Yeah. Took over as running the Studebaker Corporation until the big merger with Packard, and until I was out of there by then.
Right, yeah.
And we worked on this car in competition with Loewy and a couple of other cars, including a very small economy type car.
Really?
And we were doing some pretty good things. Mm-hmm. Then there was a show, the showdown with the Loewy car and the Exner car.
Right.
And
who were to be the judges?
The board of directors or the Studebaker management, which was really pretty well controlled by the board of directors. Mm-hmm. They had a pretty hands-on active part in that mm-hmm. corporation at the time, I think. Now Loewy had
Raymond Loewy
was very well respected in the design world, and was very well respected by the Studebaker board of directors.
This was his first contact with the Studebaker was his first contact with the automobile industry, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know that it was. It was the first big contract, and that goes back to 36.
Oh, he'd been with him since 36.
Right, he had been with him as a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
And
design consultant.
I think from 1936 on. And anyway, after this, whatever happened in this show, our car was well-liked. Mm-hmm. The Exner car was well-liked. Loewy said, well, I didn't know that you wanted anything that radical. I've got another car in the studio and I'll show it to you tomorrow.
He had brought forth a facelift
of mm-hmm. the 47
oh, okay.
car, which was not as radical as the one we had done.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I didn't, in his French accent, he said, I didn't know that you wanted anything this radical. I have, or this, this nature, I have one that's better mm-hmm. than that in the studio, and I'll show it to you tomorrow. And the guys went back to work and worked all that night and did a car. And fellows like Burke and Cotto and Vince Gardner and...
This is the Loewy team.
This was the Loewy team mm-hmm. of designers. They worked all night. And mm-hmm. and of course, I heard about these things. I could hear Don Bruce was one of that team, and he and I had become fairly friendly down there, and mm-hmm. so I knew what was going on over in that group. Anyway,
even though you're a friendly competitor.
Yeah. And I wish we had time to talk about all the personalities in the design. I think that some of the individual personalities are
amazing stories.
Let's get back to this.
This competition.
This competition before I lose the thread of that. That the next day, then, they picked Loewy's design.
Oh, they did?
And also, Loewy's contract was up
for renewal.
And in his new contract, he stipulated that he was to have absolutely no competition from any other design group. And
they bought that.
See, there was the chief engineer, let me see if I can, I don't know why his name, the chief body engineer, under Waite Smith, who was the chief engineer at Studebaker, as I said before, didn't like Loewy. And he had utilized Exner to undercut Loewy. It didn't work. And Loewy got rid of Exner.
You're jumping ahead of your story.
Well, at that time, when he rewrote his...
Before the war?
No. This is now after the war, right. And I'm there. And
yeah, okay.
But this is after this little competition and his new contract for renewal. In the new contract, he stipulated that, and really what he wanted was Exner out of the way.
Right.
Exner had pulled a pretty shady little deal while he was with Loewy.
What happened?
What happened was he was designing the car with the push from this engineer to do this car on the side.
Mm-hmm.
With a set of specifications, a package that Loewy didn't have. Now Exner was running the Loewy office.
Really?
And doing a car with one set of directions and package, and doing another car in his basement with a different set of directions from this body engineer that was pretty influential in the company.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to beat out Loewy and get rid of Loewy. And then Exner would be the man. And that backfired because when they had the showing on these cars, they had the showing in Philadelphia. Bud Manufacturing was a big factor in the Studebaker thing. And Loewy said, "Where did this car come from?" And he was told that Bud Manufacturing had designed it.
Mm-hmm.
And Loewy said, "No, Exner designed that car."
How did you know?
You could tell by looking at it that there was something funny going on.
Mm-hmm.
And he fired Exner at that moment, and then Exner went directly to work for Studebaker.
I see. Okay, good.
And then that's how I came into the picture, and Randy Farreau and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now we jump ahead for a couple of years after we'd been working on these things, and we have this competition.
Right.
And Loewy writes his new contract and gets rid of Exner. Exner goes to Chrysler.
Right.
And wanted me to go up there. I had just built a new house in South Bend, and Loewy had offered me a job to come with him stay there.
Loewy is now the Studebaker chief stylist.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Bob Burke is the man running the office.
Okay.
And we had become friendly. We all knew each other, and Bob wanted me to come over there, and I went, and I decided to stay in South Bend instead of going back to Detroit at that time, because we had two kids while we were in South Bend. We liked South Bend. It was a nice small town.
Mm-hmm.
We liked the environment. I was active in the JCs in the church, and it was a nice lifestyle.
Yeah.
And we ultimately lived there 8 years, and we added the two girls while we two of our girls were born in South Bend.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we had three kids. We had Tom and Paula and Joni.
Mm-hmm.
And I now went to work for Raymond Loewy. I worked there for a few more years.
Now Exner had offered you a job
with Chrysler, right? And he had offered me a job to come back to Chrysler with him.
Right.
And that would have probably made him a little more comfortable having somebody that he had worked with. And he had offered both Randy and I the opportunity to go to Chrysler
Randy
with
him. Farreau.
Randy Farreau.
Mm-hmm.
And both Randy and I opted to stay in South Bend and work for Loewy.
Loewy had asked you specifically to both of you to
right.
stay.
Okay. And I had always found Raymond Loewy to be a perfect gentleman and a marvelous guy to work for. I really admired the guy, and I had a lot of respect for his taste. It was different than mine, and it was you could call it a little bit fruity in a way, but he always came back. He always came back to something that was pretty automotive. And we
interesting. How would you characterize that metamorphosis from an industrial designer to an automotive designer?
Well, he hired damn good automobile designers.
Okay, fine.
However, he had the last word, and he would put get a lot of his input into it. One of the big men in his New York office was A. Baker Barnhart. A. Baker Barnhart was a designer that he had hired along with Claire Hodgman and Exner from General Motors. Now these guys, B-A-R-N-H-A-R-T, Barnhart. A. Baker Barnhart.
Okay.
We call him Barney.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was his background?
He was a designer from General Motors.
Good.